You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Thank you all for coming back this morning and continuing our conversations about these big ideas. It is my extreme honor to introduce our next keynote speaker, Dr. Nina Bandel. Nina Bandel is the Chancellor's Professor in the Department of Sociology, the Associate Vice Provost for Faculty Development, and the Co-Director for the Center of Organizational Research at the University of California, Irvine. She served as the Vice President of the American Sociological Association and is the President-elect for the Society for the Advancement of Socioeconomics. She has authored and edited a plethora of journal articles and volumes, including Economy and State, A Sociological Perspective with Elizabeth Sowers, published by Polity Press in 2010, and Money Talks, Explaining How Money Really Works, edited with Frederick Weary and Viviana Zelizar, published by Princeton University in 2020. Dr. Bandel is interested in how relational work, culture, power, and emotions influence investment, spending, debt, inequality, and ideas about the economy. Growing up in Yugoslavia and coming of age as Eastern Europe transformed rapidly after the fall of the Berlin Wall inspires Dr. Bandel to connect individuals' emotions, beliefs, and struggles with systemic transformations of communism, capitalism, and the global economy. Today, she is going to talk about the social life of money for children and dig into these ways of how markets, society, politics all interconnect and are complex and messy, as we've been talking about all weekend. And it's our pleasure to have her here. Again, join me in welcoming Dr. Nina Bandel.
Hello, everyone. I'm so pleased to be here, hopefully not too loud. I really appreciated this. I was moved by this generous introduction, Stephanie. I do wish to extend my sincere gratitude to you for this invitation to a sociologist to deliver one of the keynotes at the Markets and Society Conference, and would also especially like to thank again the organizers, Stephanie and Courtney and other staff and administrators, for everything they've done for me, for putting all these efforts into organizing a terrific conference. And I guess I have to click to know what I'm going to be talking to you about. I will talk to you about money for children. Money that parents save, expend, invest, and also borrow for the sake of kids. But I begin with a couple of confessions. First, I recognize, truly do, that sociologists and economists sometimes speak a very different language. I hope that won't be the case today and that we will seek to understand each other. And second, for full disclosure, I come here also as a parent, so I do want to recognize and appreciate all the fellow parents in the room. Are there any of you out there? Okay, I see you. I care about you. And for everyone else, a little humor never hurts. Here's a cartoon that summarizes both of my confessions, perhaps. Indeed, bedtime is very, very real. You have to go to sleep. You do have to go to sleep. So parents of young children in the room probably can relate. What is also very real is money for children. To raise a child born in 2015 to age 17, American families will spend $234,000 or so on average, and almost $450,000 if they belong to the top third in income. Now, this does not include paying for kids' college, estimated annually at around $20,000 for public and $53,000 for private universities. So parents pay. Today I'll talk to you about this and provide a sociological perspective. This is based on my research of what I call the parenting economy, research that I have been doing for the past, several years. Who counts the years of the pandemic anyway, right? So allow me to start with a quote from a colleague and friend, Nigel Dodd, a sociologist of money at the London School of Economics, who tragically passed away last year. So in his memory, I titled today's remarks. His last book was called The Social Life of Money. Nigel Dodd said, "Money is a process, not a thing, whose value derives from the dynamic, ever-changing, and often contested social relations that sustain its circulation. There will always be more forms that money can take, and indeed will take, as we adapt it to the shifting social, political, and economic circumstances." I said this out loud not only to bring his words into the room, but because I will use this quote quite literally to organize my remarks today. So first, if there are always more forms than money can take, in the empirical part of my talk, I will be discussing the new forms of money for children, with a specific focus on the proliferation of new financial instruments used for or dedicated to children. Then second, I will delve more into this idea of dynamic, changing social relations that sustain money transfers. Okay, yes, part two. So I will discuss about the changing relationship between parents and children impacted by the transformations, broader cultural transformations, in how we think about children and how we think about parenting. Then, in the third part, I will explore these social, political, and economic circumstances that shape the flow of monies within households to discuss what I call the class and color of money for children, or how financial flows within families differ because of income and racial ethnic inequalities in our society. That's what sociologists do. In the end, I will conclude with some consequences of these processes, or what we could identify as the new political economy of parenting. Well, so it is obvious that I want to talk about money for kids, but I also recognize that for many observers, when we think of children, when we think of children and their innocence in the intimate sphere of the family, we may think that this should not be or has to be strictly separate from, literally here I found a picture of cold cash in the ice cube. So a key point in the sociology of money and a major premise in my talk today is that this bold line, that it is an artificial boundary, that we need to dismantle the mythic divide between warm and fuzzy babies on the one side and cold and ruthless finance on the other side. So let me use some magic. Voila, dismantle that boundary and put money smack in the middle of understanding children and parenting. Talking about money for children does not somehow corrupt, but thinking about all the monies for children does not somehow corrupt the sacred child-parent bond, as many may fear. In fact, money is often used to affirm this relationship. Parents affirm their parenting role and relationship to their children with what they pay, invest, or borrow for children. This is part of the sociological perspective on money. So let me review this a little bit more. From a sociological perspective, we then talk about multiple monies. There's no single uniform general money, but different kinds of monies across different kinds of relationships and with different social meanings. So money has social meaning. Money evokes emotions. As Nigel Dodd said, it is truly fascinating, quote, how money is capable of arousing such contrasting thoughts and feelings, fear and excitement, loathing and desire, disgust and awe, often many at the same time. For sociologists, money is not only about value, it is about values. And monies differ across social situations and across different relationships. A key concept in sociology of money is earmarking. Yes, yes, it has its origins related to livestock, where the ears of domestic animals were marked in specific ways so that farmers could distinguish their stock from others grazing the land. So based on this, people earmark money or designate it by origin or by purpose. But earmarking is also relational. What does that mean? People mark, differentiate money depending on these social relations. They believe that different monies in a form of compensation, gift, money you are entitled to, among others, they're appropriate for different types of social relationships. So a regular paycheck is what goes with an employer-employee relationship, not a bribe, not an occasional gift. It's an exchange of labor value that is compensated. Well, one does not pay compensation to one's lover at the end of a lovely night. Most likely, that would turn the relationship into a client and prostitute. You can also imagine how some such relations are complicated. What do you give a friend who helps to babysit your child? Do you pay them compensation or do you give them a gift? What would the friend feel is appropriate? What they might be offended by? The appropriateness of monies with various categories of relations is culturally, historically, and also situationally defined. Now, we can use these conceptual building blocks to move one step further. Because of relational earmarking, which in some ways are cultural schemas, we can move to the sphere of action. People actively use money to form, maintain, negotiate, or even dissolve their social relations. People engage in relational work. Using money actively in different situations, in different ways, in order to match their economic intent with the appropriate social relations. So if it is about friends or lovers or employer employees, those relationships require different appropriate media of exchange, compensation, a gift card, paying out cash. So I'll venture out on a limb here, because you were all here the third day and you showed up for my talk. So some popular culture entertainment. How many of you know of this classic rom-com, Pretty Woman? All right, thank you. It's just for research purposes. You can admit it. So Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, two main characters here. And I won't assume, for those of you don't know, as the picture would suggest, it starts with the relationship between a prostitute and a client. She would spend 3 days as an escort and he would pay her compensation for her services. But it's a rom-com, so the relationship changes substantially. What's really interesting, and when seen after a jealousy-provoked argument, obviously jealousy belongs to a different kind of relationship than the client and service provider, to one of intimate lovers. She does not take the payment money. She wants to define their relationship as a romantic one between lovers. Taking the payment would keep it as employer-employee. So she does relational work by not doing something with money. So similarly, it is my argument that parents do relational work. Parents work at their relationship to their children. They are invested into being good parents who want to do the best by their children with what they pay for. Yet, zeroing in to this social interaction between parents and children tells a very small part of the story. A sociological perspective would also be interested in the bigger context, all that intentionally empty space here on this slide, the bigger context in which relational work takes place, the social, the historical, the political, the economic context. So I propose that parents lead entangled economic lives. What I mean by that is that families with children are entangled simultaneously in cultural trends, the meanings about this relationship, what it means to be parent, what it means to raise a child today, but also structural forces, as well as political currents. And this entangled economic lives perspective in some ways theoretically departs from previous analysis in economic sociology that conceptualized the predominant influence of any one of these circles. So, for instance, if parents take on debt for children, we have research that emphasizes the stagnant wages and the middle class squeeze that pushes parents to do so. And there's other research that emphasizes consumerism, right? The cultural finance. So the cultural perspective on this process, or the structural perspective on this process. In many ways, I want to defy these dualistic perspectives in the attempt to unravel the entanglement of multiple social forces to avoid structural or cultural reductionism. And while the visual image does not do this real justice, my PowerPoint design skills are limited. These are all still bounded circles. I count on your imagination of these boundaries to be more permeable and these forces influencing each other as much as they are influencing relational work. But what concretely are some of these entangled social forces to consider? On the side of structures and institutions, I suggest we need to examine at least the following. The rise of finance in society, especially the financing of education, the rise of the parenting product industry, both products and supplementary education industry, and the state policy related to families. On the side of culture, we should consider the changing social value of children, as we could put it, the changing meaning of child rearing. Just the fact that we call it parenting should tell you something. It's an active verb out of a noun. There's little called childing, although now there is a word called adulting, rearing. On the side of power, I invite us to account for the class, racial, ethnic, and gender inequalities in our society, among others. So with this theoretical model, that's now getting pretty complex and tangled, let's put some empirical meat to the bones. What I will report next derives from my research on the parenting economy that combines several sources of data. I've done an intellectual history and content analysis of economic ideas and parenting industry, which includes financial instruments, as well as an explosion of parenting books and manuals. Content analyzed about 100 of those since the 1940s. I also conducted quantitative analyses, and all of these with the help of my research team that I gratefully acknowledge. Large nationally representative quantitative data sets, probably familiar to the audience in this room, the Survey of Consumer Finances, a triennial survey, the Consumer Expenditure Survey, the panel study of income dynamics traces the same families over time, while the other ones are cross-sectional, and also talking to parents. 120 interviews with parents, mothers and fathers, with at least one child in middle school, ages 9 to 13. The parents we talked to, as the bottom part of this slide shows, are very diverse. They're diverse in terms of their income, in terms of their race and ethnicity, in terms of their education completed, their housing situation, their political attitudes, actually also religious attitudes, immigrant generations. This is probably one of the most diverse original interview data sets of American parents. And it was intentional to look at a broad swath. Mostly, we focus on how people differ based on income, based on race and ethnicity. I'd say the sociological default families today have in common, one could ask, right? And notably, these data come from the United States. And I recognize that several of you in this room are from other countries. I myself was born and raised in former Yugoslavia, now Slovenia. So an empirical question remains how these trends travel. And we can talk a little bit about that if you'd like in the Q&A. Now, what did I find? Going back to this four parts, right? New monies, the class and color of money, the changing social meanings, and then the consequences. The first one points to money's multiplicity, its protein nature. What are some of the new monies for children? And to be sure, the fact that financial activities are entwined with intimate relations is not a novel trend. It's been there since forever. However, I propose that we have witnessed in the past decades a qualitative shift in how finance has influenced American parenting. Financialization brings with it an augmented variety of financial media available to parents. Parents begin to use various financial instruments such as stocks, bonds, certificates of deposit, money market accounts that could be opened under children's names or co-owned with one's children. There are also earmarked education investment accounts. In the U.S., they're called 529 savings plans. These are pre-tax savings plans offered by states to be used toward children's educational expenses. Reports show that the amount of assets put aside at 529s grew to nearly $330 billion as of end year 2018, with the number of these accounts open rising to nearly 14 million. Various lines of credit and loans are also available to support mostly children's college education. Families, for instance, have used Federal PLUS loans, the parent loans for undergraduate students, PLUS, at an increasing rate since the 1990s, reaching nearly $90 billion in balances in 2019. So it's not surprising that we detect such trends also in our analyses of the Survey of Consumer Finances data. So what I will present are four graphs that capture the share of families with children that engage in a specific financial practice between 2001 and 2016. So first, to establish a baseline, this is about parents holding savings for children. And we see that it has somewhat increased during this time period, but it's not really a noticeable growing trend, especially if we compare it to financial assets for children or under children's names, money market accounts, stocks, bonds, etc., what I mentioned before. We can see how this practically emerges on the scene after 2000. Now, similar trends are noticeable for a specific kind of money for children, education savings, so mostly 529s, but also others that families could have. And as I will show later, this is certainly not widespread across all families, so it's important to figure out who holds these. But generally speaking, they have risen substantially. On the flip side of this process, we could say, parents also increasingly take on debt. So these numbers are for parents who are 40 or older, because we don't have the question survey of consumer finances about college loans for kids. We know about college loans, so we want to make sure that it's not capturing mostly loans that parents still have for their own education. Using this entangled economic life perspective, these trends certainly have to do with financialization of the American economy, with specifically availability of credit. Americans at the turn of the 21st century have much more access to loans than in previous decades. There are also lower amounts of state funding for higher education, together with rising tuition. And there's also considerable growth in the parenting products or services industry, not only in consumer markets, which supplies the gamut of baby gadgets one can or should have these days. There's also notably exploding supplementary education industry. That's all the academic enrichment activities and tutoring services and coaching for admission to college and all sorts of other kinds of services. This used to be called shadow education, but it has definitely come out of its shadow. So it's more properly referred to as supplementary education. And anyone with children ages, you know, 15 to 17 in high school getting ready for college probably knows what I'm talking about. All these structural changes are very real, yet equally important is to pay attention to cultural shifts in society. I want to argue that the rise in monies for children is reflective of a cultural transformation in the value of children and meaning of parenting, which we could characterize, as the words in the slide suggest, as a move from providing for children to investing in children. Or from a focus on child-rearing expenditures as the type of money to parenting investments. Of course, here, I need to remember a Tour de Force book by Viviana Zelizer, brilliant sociologist at Princeton University, who actually was the Mercatus speaker last year. She wrote a book called Pricing the Priceless Child, in which she documented the transformation from what she so aptly called economically useful child in the late 1800s, one that worked in the fields, mines, and factories to secure the help with the economic welfare of the family, from the economically useful child to an emotionally priceless child, one that is put on the pedestal to be loved and cherished at the turn of the 20th century, sacralized. Well, today, this emotional pricelessness is still the case, but Zelizer's analysis ends in the 1930s. The society has drastically transformed culturally, politically, and economically since then, when Zelizer finished her historical analysis. The social value of children has transformed with it. Can we talk then about Priceless Child 2.0? Indeed, love for children seems to be upgraded to investment in children, as we could also see from this Google Ngram scanning all books in English that the Google search engine has access to, shows this pretty nicely. And shameless self-promotion, I have recently argued in this article in Theory and Society that Priceless Child of the New Millennium is a human capital investment child. That is, investment into children is not just a general phenomenon. It is about investing in good education. It is about building human capital, and it's parents that are responsible for investing into skill building of children from a very early age on, actually, even in a womb. Some of you may have come across advice about playing Mozart to your unborn baby. Here's one parent, John, that we talked to, who in some way summarizes the sentiment about financial investment into children. I think as a parent, you're going to sacrifice whatever you can for the kids. You'd hate there for there to be something where the finances are such that you want something for the kids that you cannot afford to get for them. There's a heartbreaking quality to that. So when we discuss the cultural transformations, what's key, and another Google Ngram for you, is that it's not just about children, not just about what parents should do for children and about child rearing or parenting styles. It is equally about a shift how we think of parents and parenthood. What is the role of parents? What is the meaning of being a parent? Family sociologists have spent a lot of time documenting what we call intensive parenting. You may have not heard the word intensive, although you see the rise in those discussions here, but you may have heard the notion of helicopter parenting, snowplow parenting, sledgehammer parenting. The intense focus on doing everything one can, clearing like snowplowing, watching over over-involvement in some ways into children. what I've tried to signal with this title of invested parenthood is that it's not just about the children and what parents have to do with the children, but it's also very much about the identity of parents, a certain kind of parenthood that is working hard to be a good parent. It's become a job. A good parent works hard at it and with passion. Indeed, studies show that parental time spent with children has increased since the 1960s considerably, even if parents, especially moms, have less time than they did then, because most of them work in the labor market. But time spent with children has gone up over time. Why has the notion of parenthood changed? Well, there are many reasons, but the way I was trying to track it empirically is to content analyze parenting books. Since the 1940s, in fact, if you click today on Amazon.com, you type in parenting as a category, you will get around 60,000 hits. Here are some. And what's interesting over time is not that there are more of them. Some of you may remember Dr. Spock, not the Star Trek one, but Dr. Benjamin Spock, a pediatrician and psychologist who wrote a parenting book that used to be also called the Parenting Bible. So it gives you a sense how important it was and widely read. Since then, what we've seen is that there's not only an explosion of advice, but who gives advice has changed. No longer pediatricians and psychologists and parenting experts with, you know, a PhD, MD after their names, but journalists, moms who go to France and then write a book, Raising Bebe or Bringing Up Bebe here, even the book What to Expect When You're Expecting, supposedly a book read by 93% of expecting mothers in the U.S., written by Heidi Markov. She's not an OBGYN or a pediatrician. She was a mother. That was her main credential writing this book. Obviously, pulled in experts, but the impetus was that we write about emotionally evocative experience, these narratives. And as a sociologist, I will have to think critically about them in how they serve to discipline the identity of parents, in most cases mothers, into a particular image. And not even to mention mommy influencers, that's a specific group of influencers on social media, a phenomenon of its own, that too elevates parenthood as the master status to an identity that overpowers all others. Bottom line, parenting is not only intensive, but it is invested. In the words of one of our respondents, I won't read everything, but provide more for you to have a context. Let's just focus on, you know, doing all these things for children. If we eliminated them, I just don't know what life would be. Are they just going to be at home then playing videos? It just feels like I'm a bad parent at that point. So to recap, families take on increasing financial investments and debt for the sake of kids to pursue a moral imperative to not only provide for, but invest in their children, especially children's education. And the imperative is not only about what to do with the children, but importantly, what it means to be a good parent. Now, since the parent just previously quoted mentioned extracurricular activities, I do want to acknowledge the prototypical image of American intensive parenting, overscheduling of kids in Kumon, Russian School of Math, Mathinasium, coding, Minecraft, robotics, violin lessons, dance lessons, chess, fencing, horseback riding, flag football. Indeed, nearly all parents we spoke to enroll their children into activities. Some sociological perspectives in the 1980s found that it's the middle class and the upper middle class that cultivates their children through these. It's become broadly widespread across classes. But most popular ones are sports. And here is how one parent thinks why these extracurriculars are important. And while you may guess it's because we need to build the child's resume for college, a lot of parents of these middle schoolers actually focus on building a child's character, their values. They're giving them opportunities for social interaction or teaching them life lessons, as this dad, Kevin, here explained. Teaching kids how to lose. When they're adults, it seems people don't know how to lose, and then it's really hard to live the life. Crazy things can happen. But the kids, his kids, are able to play sports, and they're able to learn those lessons on the field. It's also important to know that the major expenses for children, despite, again, the media stories out there, are not in extracurricular activities. A very big one is related to housing. Taking on mortgage debt to reside in good school neighborhoods, as this mom here said, they moved for their daughter, give the daughter a better future with a really broad sense of future, not, you know, the job and kind of opportunities in the labor market, but to realize her potential. That's the pricelessness of children that still comes through these interviews. For those who, you know, sure words, sure interviews, but what about some numbers? Here I have some. Comparing families with children to those without, and note that with children is up to age 25 because of the delayed transition to adulthood and kids going through college and parents supporting them there. There's higher mortgage debt over time for families with children. Interestingly, we don't actually see this difference, and this is also in regression models and with time, you know, child interactions, significant for the mortgage, but not statistically significant for credit card debt over time. So I would say that this says something about uncovering the new social life of money for children that shifts to an emphasis on long-term investment, not short-term provision and consumption. Parenting investment monies, not necessarily just child-rearing expenditures and buying that extra toy. Although I do know that always also happens and is expensive. Yet these monies for children are also very unequal. I examine how a family's class and racial background matters for their financial behavior. Note, this pertains to this third sphere. I won't talk about gender inequality on the slides, but happy to address some in the Q&A. Mostly this will be comparing families from different income brackets, 0 to 30% income, 30 to 60, 60 to 90, and the top income decile, and comparing across racial and ethnic categories with the limitations of the data in the Survey of Consumer Finances, distinguishing those who identify as white, as Black, and as Hispanic. There's unfortunately not further racial ethnic delineation that we can do with those data. And I'm also going to use two instruments only, not to overload you, but to create a contrast here, financial assets for children and debt for children. So for the financial assets, this is breaking numbers down by income categories. You can see how very uneven this investment is. The families that have financial assets for children or under children's names are in the incomes in the top income decile with the fine dotted line. Others have much less. And when we look at the racial ethnic categories, it is white families that have much more of these financial assets compared to Hispanic and Black ones. On the other hand, education debt is in some ways the flip side of this story. First, in income groups, those in lower income groups have increasingly more steep slopes. So groups between 0 and 30 and 30 and 60 are the top lines. And it is also Black families who have significantly more education debt. I portray this as leverage, that is to understand what a burden the debt is compared to assets, and Black families have significantly more over time compared to whites. Just to give you a bit of a sense as to how difficult it is, but also how committed parents from lower classes are to supporting their children. As a parent, I would do what I could to help my children. And Edward here, I would do it in a heartbeat. So these narratives show parents engaged in relational work, but with what consequences? In my last 5 minutes, I think. We might have started a little later than at the hour. I will conclude with a few implications, or outlining what we could call the new political economy of parenting in the US. As we have gleaned from some of these narratives, parents make sacrifices. They have to prioritize. We actually asked, what would you prioritize if you had to? Your own retirement savings or monies for children? Actually, even before we asked the question, this one mom blurted out, "For my son," she said. "For me, I don't need much. I have modest expectations of what I will need. With my son, you know, nobody's going to give you that time back. And they can't say that you were not a good parent," see this notion again, "or that you didn't give what they needed." And actually, we can look at the retirement savings and we can see whether there is a difference. And you will see it's very similar to figures for financial investment and debt, that retirement savings are accumulated over time among sort of the parenting 10%. And increasingly less, statistically significantly less for Black families. The interaction with Hispanic actually over time is not significant comparing white and Hispanic. This picture says more than 1,000 words. It's about the infamous wealth inequality in America. If the U.S. land were divided like wealth, 1% would own 40% of that land. Top 10% would own 80% of the land, and 40% would own that red dot, that one small town in Texas. The disparities are huge. But what's important to bear in mind from the point of view of the parenting economy is that wealth inequality is starkest and growing within families with children, which is also what my colleagues, demographers, have shown. So families' net worth, same trends are for retirement savings, growing gaps over time, significant gaps. White families typically have 8 times the wealth of the typical Black families and 5 times the wealth of the typical Hispanic families. And these figures are averages, which means they're skewed by the top end of the distribution. Here's a chart that considers median values. The racial wealth gap among families with children is striking. The median value for families with children up to 25, the last line for 2016, around $500 for Black families, around $5,000 for Hispanic families, and $96,000 for a white family. The U.S. also has poorer child health outcomes than other wealthy nations. While child mortality has been progressively declining across all countries, child mortality in the U.S. has been higher than in peer nations since the 1980s. From 2001 to 2010, the risk of death in the U.S. was 76% greater for infants and 57% greater for children ages 1 through 19 than in other OECD countries. U.S. also has one of the highest child poverty rates among rich countries. 1 in 7 children of color, 1 in 6 under 5 live in poverty. 11 million children live in poverty in one of the richest countries in the world. Yet perhaps children, all children matter. Children are our true currency. Perhaps they're not a stock of private parental investment with exhausted parents emotionally and financially barely hanging on, but they are a common good. So I leave you with this admittedly utopian message for the future of money for children, a message that seeks hope and affirms our common humanity. Thank you so very much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.